So, any questions from the morning? Are you all good? That's something which, purely from within this class, you wouldn't know. But it's if you look in these notes, which is kind of the longer version of Weinrich's book, the bottom line is that in when you do the story of how fields, you know, you, at some point you're trying to get things to be Lorentz invariant, so you say that you have when you because things are going to be local, you're trying to do things in terms of Fourier transforms of the creation dilation operators, but then the whole spiel about things commuting at space-like separations says you have to add the complex conjugate. In that spiel, when you then start writing down the Hamiltonian, you just see that you can define what you mean by it. So once you see that you've got these two terms, where that's the antiparticle, then you know what you mean by C. C is just, you know, you replace A with A bar. And then P and T, you knew what they were. And then what you just do is you say, well, if I take the Hamiltonian now and I just do C, P, and T, just the condition that the Hamiltonian be real and Lorentz invariant, it automatically makes it CPT invariant. And it's but in today when I said that they were the same, you don't need to. There's two ways to see that the where it came up to this morning was I didn't make the argument very well for the why the coefficients, if you have a complex coefficient that would break CP or would break T. And I tried to argue it through T, but you can argue it through C, P as well. Because if you have, if I take A with and replace it with A bar, that's has the effect in this kind of an expansion of just complex conjugating things, right? Because if I got complex conjugated, I'm just going to essentially have the A's on, A's with stars and the A's will have stars, which is what I would have gotten if I'd replaced A with A star and phi. So if I have a Lagrangian, which is some coefficient times something built into the phi, so you know, so phi to the n with derivatives and stuff. And if I take a CP transformation, CP inverse, so I don't want to use a constant k, then it'll become CP derivatives of phi and stuff, CP inverse. And the effect of CP inverse is just to replace this by the complex conjugates. And so you've almost got, so let's say this thing had been a complex thing, so I had plus complex conjugate and I had plus complex so this is almost the complex conjugate of L, except I didn't complex conjugate the coefficients. But if I had, then I would have had the complex conjugate of L, which I know is equal to L because that's the reality of the Lagrangian. So this kind of shows you that if you want things to be CP invariant, you would have had this being the complex conjugate of L if K had been real. And so that's kind of why complex K is screwing up CP invariant. Because the action of CP, which is changing particle to antiparticle, and the parity, you might have said, well, why isn't this just C rather than CP? And it morally is, it's just that the parity is, I'm being sloppy about exactly what happens to the quantum numbers of these states when I switch C and P. And normally I'd fix the spin index and the momentum index, but it's convenient actually if you also change P. If you do a parity transformation, so all the momenta reverse themselves. That's actually has a simpler action on the fields than parity conjugation by itself does. So there's a technical point there, but the bottom line is that this combination CP has the effect of essentially complex conjugating the fields, but it's doing it only to the operators because you're applying it as a unitary transformation in the Hilbert space, and it doesn't see the constants. And you could do the same thing. That's related to the CPT statement. If I did time reversal on everything, then time reversal, because it's anti-unitary, comes through and it explicitly complex conjugates all the constants and then doesn't do anything else here. And so if I had done both, CP is complex conjugating the operators, but T would then complex conjugate the coefficients, and that's kind of why the Lagrangian ends up being invariant all the time. And there's a much longer spiel on that in those notes if you want to look for it. CPT, the statement is if you have a local Lorentz invariant field theory, then it is CPT invariant. And it's the argument that something like this says that once you've made it local and Lorentz invariant, then for free it just happens that CPT is taking L to itself. So it's just a theorem. And so the things you could do to violate the theorem would be to not be Lorentz invariant, because then that's what, you know, that's like non-relativistic field theory, and or not be local, because then it's important in the locality argument that you're everything's evaluated at the same point here, because but yeah, I think it's true that there's not a redundant assumption there. You need locality and you need Lorentz invariants to conclude that it's CPT invariant. But CP invariance is something which you're not forced to have. And in the standard model, the statement would be that we designed the standard model in a way which we didn't give a shit about CP invariance, but we just took what we had to have from gauge invariance and from the particle content that was there. And then one of the themes of the standard model is that you do that and you get all these other things for free. And so one of the things you get for free is that you get CP violation, but not in the leptonic sector, only in the quark sector, and only together with flavor changing in a very particular way. And when you go out and when we get to this part of the course where we look at the evidence for CP violation, it's exactly got the features that the standard model is telling you it should have, which is kind of phenomenal, because it's not, you didn't design it to do that. It just for free has all these other things like CP invariance, and it describes the parity violation exactly the way it appears to be seen, and it's going to describe, you know, the conservation of baryon number is exactly the way it's supposed to be, but we're not designing it to be that. It's just coming up for free. Violating. Yeah, certainly it's been seen. We know that nature is not CP preserving, right? Yeah, no, once you get the book, it's in chapter 9. But there's a kaon who's, if CP had been conserved, this thing has, it's odd under CP, because the K long. And so it has to decay, if CP is conserved, into at least, it decays into pions all the time. And the pions are themselves CP odd. And so if the kaon decays into pions, it has to decay into an odd number of them. So it can't decay into less than 3 of them, it turns out. So if you ever saw this thing decay into 2 pions, you would know that CP wasn't a good quantum number. And it decays into 2 pions 1 time in 1,000 or something like that. So that was how it was discovered. And so so every once in a while it goes to 2 pions. And so then the question became, so now you've seen it. It's been seen in other places now too. It's, you know, in more recently in B decays, it's also known that there's a CP violation going on. And you can test the, now that it's been seen more than once, you have the chance to try and test what the standard model is telling you you should be seeing in a better way than you could have done in the old days when it was just seen once. And the short version is that it really works extremely well, and it's exactly the way that the experiments are telling it should be. And there are other things, once you see it in detail, you'll see there's other things you could have imagined having that you don't get the standard model, and which you don't see in the data, and people thought might be happening in the 60s, but it's not true. But the nature works like that. Yeah. CKM, yeah. CP violation, yeah. It's not small. That was the main message of the matrix, is that people thought because CP violation is rare, it's more rare than parity violation, in the sense that this happens only 1 time in 1,000 or so, so instead of every second time. And people thought that could be because there's some sort of a CP violating interaction in nature which is weaker than the weak interaction, because the weak interaction is what makes this thing decay at all. And the standard model description is actually that's not right. It happens that the phase in the KM matrix, the CKM matrix, is pretty much as big as it could possibly be. And in that parameterization where we had, it was, you know, it was 1 minus lambda squared over 2 and lambda minus lambda, Then over here, there was an A lambda cubed rho plus I eta or something like that. A rho and eta, eta is the thing that's the phase, because that's the complex part. A rho and eta are essentially one, if you look at the experiments. And the only, all the smallness in the CKM, in these experiments of the CP violation is to do with the fact that lambda is 0.2. And if you look at, and you need at least three generations to be in every, you have to have a process which knows about all three generations before you see any CP violation at all. And that, if you, that means that if you're starting off with kaons, which only involve the quarks in the first two generations, then you have to be, it's going to involve quantum effects that kind of, you have to produce a top quark or a bottom quark, and the coupling constant factors and the smallness of lambda conspire to give you the extra 10 to the minus 3 that you would need. So it turns out that it's all accidental stuff that's making it small, and the phase is actually not particularly small at all. It's not so, you know, it's 0.2, so it's not like fantastically small, but it's, there's no theoretical explanation for that. No, it's just, as far as we know now, it's just data says it's small. It could have been, in principle, anything, but that's what it turned out to be. And if you go to the neutrinos, we now know the neutrinos have a similar matrix. They have not the same pattern. There was a prejudice, which I must say I did not share at the time, but there's many papers which you can ignore, before 5 years ago, where people assumed that the leptons would have the same pattern that is mostly diagonal, but the neutrinos, it turns out they off-diagonal things are one, and so they oscillate like crazy. So we also don't understand that, but so we know there's at least two patterns in nature, and neither of them do we understand. Okay. So I think I said everything about the charge current interaction I wanted to say. Yeah. Keyword there is claim. No, I don't think there's anyone who would say yet that string theory can tell you why lambda is there, or what the value of lambda is. The string theory is at the level of, you can find vacua of string theory where the states, the massless states, have the quantum numbers of the standard model particles, including the Higgs field. And but they typically, it's true that in the vacua that have that property, there's other particles too, which might not be a problem. But you can't, it's hard to predict the masses, because in string theory, you're handicapped just technically to look near supersymmetric minima. And it turns out that supersymmetry, well, you may not see in this course, but it's just true that supersymmetry can be broken in the same way that the standard model gauge group is broken. But if it's not broken classically, then it doesn't break any order in perturbation theory. So typically, it's a non-perturbative thing, which is a good thing, because you're looking for a small breaking on the scales of the string. You know, you're looking for it to break at the weak scale rather than the Planck scale. But it makes it hard to calculate. So you can calculate what the masses are in the limit of supersymmetry not being broken, and they're all zero, and that's the right answer. And they all get a mass when supersymmetry breaks. And unless you can calculate the masses, you can't calculate these mixing angles. And so people don't really have a good handle on what they are. It happens that these Yukawa couplings that are to do with the masses in string theory often are coming, they're related to the topology, the internal dimensions. So there's, in principle, you could imagine making a theory of it. If you could actually calculate things, there's some of the ingredients, you have something you can say about geometrically, but people haven't got anywhere there yet. But it's because I think it's one of the, it shouldn't be held against them, because it's one of the things that you'd like to get to, but there's other things you want to get to first, which they're still trying to do. Any other questions? There was I've heard mutterings of fear about the assignment. That's it always reminds me of the beginning of Apocalypse Now, right? I love the smell of napalm in the morning. It smells like victory. That's completely natural. Everybody's panicked when the assignment is about a couple weeks away from being due. So you're on schedule if you're panicked. So don't channel your panic into a good place and use it as a force for goodness, and it'll all pay off. But also come talk to me if you have questions with the this point. So the next thing would be the neutral current interactions. So those are, if we go back to where we started off with, you know, the fermion gauge couplings were coming from the kinetic terms, L bar. And we were focusing, when we wrote out the covariant derivatives in terms of a 2x2 matrix to see where the different gauge bosons couple, we were focusing on the off-diagonal pieces, right? So we had, if we wrote this out here, this term here, there was a minus 1/2 L bar M P slash minus. So this is, again, hypercharge minus 1/2. Now I'm going to write in these terms I wasn't writing in before. B slash. Plus. Ah. Start again. I want to write this whole thing in the matrix here. So let me write this out. Minus 1/2. E bar, E bar. Transpose. B slash. Minus I. Over 2. I'll leave the coupling constants out. Now I'm writing the Pauli matrices out here, so I've got W3 slash times G2, and we had minus G1 E slash. Oh, there's that. Yeah, thanks. minus I over 2. Then there's off-diagonal stuff. And then here we had minus G2 W3 slash minus G1 W slash. And again, this is curly. And so on for the other guys, right? We had, we could do the same thing for the quarks, and they would have had, the only difference would be the coefficient here would be different if we had quarks, because their hypercharges would be different. And if we did the singlet leptons, we would have had contributions from B, but we wouldn't have any W's in those cases because they're not coupling to the SE2. So I'd like to describe the whole schmear with one pass. I'm focusing on the diagonal guys now. And so it's useful to think of the diagonal things are always linking the same field on both sides. So it's nu bar nu, or E bar E. And for every field in this list, you can write this thing, provided I put the coefficients here. I could write the 1/2 as being T3. That's the T3 eigenvalue for this thing. And the minus 1/2 down here is the T3 eigenvalue for this fermion. And if I put the hypercharge here and here, I could write a general expression once and for all as to how the neutral bosons are coupling, which I'd like to do so I don't have to do them all separately. So the general form is, for the neutral current couplings, is going to be, so this is the couplings of the B and the W3. So I'm going to keep the minus minus, I'll have plus I over 2. Sum over fermions, I over 2, fermion bar, gamma mu. So we'll have, if it has a third component of isospin, it's going to have a coupling of G2 times the third component of isospin. Gamma left. What I'm about to do is, do you want me to do the detail of this, the same detail I did the off-diagonal terms? I'm about to skip some steps here, which I will not do if it's going to bother you. So what I'm going to do is, for instance, group the gamma lefts the way that they're going to come out. The story for the charge W's was that in the end of the day, we ended up with an overall gamma left because the only thing that was coupling the W was were the left-handed doubles. And that seemed mysterious halfway through the calculation because when I did there was no gamma left here at all. There was a gamma left and a gamma right. But I made this argument that the gamma right term was really the gamma left term in disguise if you use the properties of Majorana spinners. And so in the end of the day, once we wrote things in terms of the final fermions, there was a gamma left. The W's only appeared together with the gamma left because they only actually coupled to the left-handed fermion. And are you happy for me to do that again here? It's the same argument as before. It's just that instead of being neutrino electron, it's electron-electron. It's the same as before. So since I don't hear no, I'll do that. So the W3s are coupling in this way. And T3 here is the T3 for the fermion. So this is the eigenvalue, if you like. So T3 for the fermion is plus or minus a half, where it's plus a half if you're at the top of a doublet, and it's minus a half at the bottom of a doublet. And you don't have to decide what it is for the right-handed fields because they don't couple to W. So it's only the left-handed guys that are appearing. So if you're ever talking about a fermion, this term, you're always talking about left-handed pieces, so they always appear in a doublet, so you always know what T3 means. It's either plus or minus a half. Plus a half for the neutrinos and the up quarks, minus a half for the electrons and down quarks. And we want to now also follow the Bs. The Bs are getting two kinds of contributions. They're getting contributions from the left and the right-handed fields. The left-handed fields are getting their contribution from here. So there's a B hidden in here because this has a hypercharge. For the leptons, there's a hypercharge. Y was minus a half for L. And there's also a B in here because Y for E was plus one. But they had different hypercharge so that I have to keep track separately of. And this is the one that has the left-handed fields in it. This ultimately has the right-handed fields in it. And so the hypercharge for the left and right-handed fields I should keep track of separately. So let me do that. So we'll have system of W3 mu. So for B, I'm going to have a similar statement. I'm going to have plus G1 times the hypercharge of the left-handed field times gamma left times D mu plus the hypercharge of the right-handed field times gamma right times D mu. Let me not write M because right now I'm writing sum over all the fermions anyway, so that's sum over M is in there. Now let me make sure I didn't lie to you with that. So I kind of cut to the chase here and yes. God is great. All right, that's the bottom line. That's the neutral current couplings. And what we're trying to do now is first thing I want to do is I want to rewrite W3 and B in terms of the mass eigenstates for the spin 1 particles, the Z and the A's. And then what I want to do is take the fermions and write them in terms of the mass eigenstates for the fermions. Or we can actually do that part first. So the fermions are easy. Fermions are easy because unlike for the W bosons, it's the same fermion on both sides here. Remember what happened for the W bosons is we had a W mu times, something like neutrino. If this is destroying a W, this has to great electron, E bar M, gamma mu, gamma left, neutrino, something like that was what we would have had. We did a rotation of the E's, which gave us did a different rotation on the nu's, and so we ended up with a matrix here, which would have been, it was U dagger, E, U neutrino, MN, after we went to the mass matrix. And then we were free to choose this to be equal to this, and so to make this the unit matrix because we hadn't had a neutrino mass. But what's going to happen in this case for free, it's going to be literally the same thing, except we're going to have U dagger F, UF on both sides because it's the same fermion appearing on both left and right. And so it's, no matter what U was, because it's unitary, this is always going to be one. So for the same reason that the kinetic terms were also, we chose unitary transformations because we didn't want to screw up the kinetic terms. And these are coming from the same kind of term as the kinetic term. So that's why we're for free finding that they're diagonal. The thing that was strange about the W bosons was that it wasn't the same fermion on both sides. And so that then cared about the difference between the rotation you required on the electron and the neutrino, and then that cared about the fact that the masses were different for those two kinds of things. So the main message is that I can make this, these are now the mass eigenstates. And they can be the Dirac field too, because if I follow through where these gamma lefts and gamma rights were, they're always being applied to the field, which is for the Dirac field. So the fermionic part in this case is just goes through, and it's equally true for the mass eigenstates as it is for the weak eigenstates. And that's an important success of the standard model, that the interactions of the Z boson don't change fermion type. And that's partly due to the fact that it's diagonal here. You're looking at the pieces which are taking field to field, but then it also survives the rotation that you do to diagonalize the mass matrix, because it's the same field on both sides, and you're doing a unitary transformation. So the real guts of the diagonalization of this thing is in the diagonalizing of the writing the W3 and B in terms of the mass eigenstates. So remember how that was done. We had W3 mu and B mu. That was a rotation of the Z mu, E mu, and the rotation was cosine theta, let me write this, C, cosine theta W, and there was a sine. There's always a sine, there's always a sine, S-I-G-N, in one of these signs, S-I-N-E, and I always get it wrong. I think what we want is top right. Well, you've got to be careful it's not this or the inverse. It's always the one that appeared in the combination. Z has a minus sign in it. Yes, the Z head, so I think it's the bottom left. I think what you guys are remembering is that if I wrote ZA, then it's top right. Because the thing that was appearing in the Higgs mass term, the Higgs kinetic term, was always the difference between W3 and B. Here we had the sum. It was always this guy in the bottom here. But for the Higgs field, the hypercharge of the Higgs field was the opposite for the lepton doublet. So you actually had a plus sign here. So it was the Z is involves the relative minus sign. So check your notes. I can check my notes. Oh, check my notes. Yes. So that's right. So we can just do the algebra here, right? So we have, if I just take the square bracket, that's going to be, so it's G2, T3, gamma left. Now W3 is cosine theta Z mu plus sine theta A mu. And then here we have plus G1, hypercharge left, gamma left, times, and in fact, there's a B in both the terms, so I might as well just add these things. So it's hypercharge left, plus hypercharge right, gamma right, and times B, and B is minus sine theta Z mu plus cosine theta. So we can just group terms. So we've got Z mu. Let's do A first, because A is the one that we hope should be simple. So we have A mu times. So we've got G2 times T3. I'll group the gamma lefts and the gamma rights. So with gamma left, I've got G2 times T3 times the cosine of theta W. That's this there. And then there's also a plus G1 hypercharge left times cosine of theta W. And then the gamma right term is just coming from here. And that's just G1 hypercharge right times cosine theta W. And then I add to that the Z terms. There's a gamma left, comes with G2, T3, cosine theta W. And over here, we've got minus g1 y left sine theta w left gamma right minus g1 y right sine theta w. Now, you're supposed to remember that for all the fields, the left and the right-handed fields, it was true that the electric charge was T3 plus Y. And for the left-handed fields, T3 wasn't zero. And for the right-handed fields, T3 was zero. But it was still true that this formula held. So if I specialize this to the left-handed fields, that says that Q is equal to T3 plus Y. For the right-handed fields where T3 was zero, that just means that Q is equal to Y. So this would be Y left, Y right. So I'm just specializing this formula to the two cases where I'm using the special information that T3 is zero for the right-handed fields because they're singlets. So if we do that, you see that there's a potentially a nice thing that happens here. That I also want to use, I guess I should, before I do that, it might be useful to group the But do I want to do that first? Let's just say I want to use this relationship to trade y for q. And it's probably going to be simpler. This term is going to look simpler if I take advantage of the fact that the G2s are related. Sorry, so let me remind you now. Sine theta w was g1 over the square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared. And cosine theta w was g2 divided by the square root of g1 squared plus g2 squared. I know that because the thing multiplying w3 is always g2. So that was the cosine. The thing multiplying b was always g1. That was the sine. So you can kind of see, in particular, that the things appearing in this combination, g2 sine theta is the same thing as g1 cosine theta. G2 sine theta is just g1 g2 over the square root g1 squared plus g2 squared. And that's equal to g1 cosine theta. So let's call that b in a leading piece of notation. And that means that this is a common factor here. And what's appearing here is T3 plus Y left. And it's also the same factor that's appearing here, right? G1 cosine theta. So the square bracket is A mu, is E times A mu, because we have these common factors coming out, times gamma left. So this is, let's call this Q left and Q right. Which is the same for both. Let's just call it Q. Let's just gonna. So we got, and I factor these things out. So I've got T3 plus Y left, which is that, Q. And here I've got just Y right, well, that's also Q. So what I've really got here is gamma left plus gamma right, which is 1, times Q. So this whole thing here is just Q. If I look at this now, this has got not G2 sine theta, it's got G2 cosine theta and G1 sine theta. And so you can see that those are not the same. So I've got G2 cosine theta is G2 squared over the square root of G1 squared. G2 squared. And G1 sine theta W is G1 squared. But if I use this, E is the product over the square, over the sum. I can write both these things as, I calculate E over sine theta W cos theta W. That's G1 G2 divided by the square root divided by the sine, and the cos is going to be G1 G2 divided by the square root squared, right? So that's equal to the G1 G2's cancel, and I've just got the square root of G1 squared G2 squared. And that's something which holds that thought. Let me write one more thing here. What I should do before you want that thought is let me eliminate y left and y right for q, just using those formulas. So I can just write here, what I'll use is I'll call y left, that's just q minus t3. And y right here is just q again. So if I follow the t3s and the q's here, I've got t3 is multiplying g2 cosine minus g1 sine. Plus g1 sine, sorry, because there's a minus sign there and a minus sign there. And so that's where I wanted to go. So let me just write that intermediate step here. So if I follow, I've got gamma left. I'm following the T3 term, so let me write the T3. I've got T3 times G2 gamma left G2 G2 cosine theta W plus G1 sine theta W. That's this term and that term. And I've got the Q terms are going to be Q times, so Q is multiplying minus gamma left sine theta to minus G1 sine theta gamma left. And I've got also minus G1 sine theta gamma right. Right? So now come back to this thought. This combination here, G2 cosine theta plus G1 sine theta, is this plus this. I'm going to get G1 squared plus G2 squared divided by the square root. So that's just equal to the square root. And that's just equal to this, which is equal to this. Oh, sorry, that's gamma right. Thank you. This is why I owe the money to you. This is going to be like one of those ponds, right, where you find all these pennies around during the concerts. So make a wish. Yeah, and that's because I designed, remember the way, so think about the electron in particular, right? We had two ways to think about the electron, and we had the electron, part of it was in here, part of it was in here. And so when I thought of it as living here, so it was, you know, we had nu E. If I followed the left-handed field here, so that's the thing, that's the electron, not the positron, for this guy, then in this case, it had T3 equals minus a half because it was the bottom part of a doublet. And I knew that it had charge equal to minus one because it's an electron. And so that told me how to choose y. So I chose y for this field to be minus a half, so that this plus this gave me that. But when I did the same thing for E, the right-handed piece of E is the electron. And so the right-handed piece of E had T3 equals zero because it was not a doublet. It's because it's the right-handed piece, it still got charge minus one. But the hypercharge of the right-handed field here was the thing that I needed to make this work, and that was, in this case, it's minus one. I was, in a previous class, I was talking about the left-handed piece, so I equals to plus one. But you can kind of see that the hypercharges that I'm choosing here are being forced to be different because the T3s are different, but they're being designed to make the Qs the same because it's electron in both cases. And that's why I'm using the same Q in both cases. So cut to the chase, this is E over sine theta cos theta, because it's this plus this, which is the square root of G1 squared plus G2 squared, which is equal to that. Whereas this, G1 sine theta, is, you know, if I had had G1 cos theta, I would have been a happy person, right? Because G1 cos theta is just, G1 cos theta is E. So let me write that as being no, better still, let me pull this as an overall factor out front. So I'm going to write G1. I want to write G1 sine theta as, so G1 sine theta is this. I want to write it as being this, which is the square root times something. So it's the square root, so it's E over sine theta cos theta. Well, the square root, so this is the square root times G1 squared over G1 squared plus G2 squared, right? Because if I pull a factor of square root up front here, I have to divide by another factor to get the same thing. But this, you recognize, is just sine squared theta. So that's sine squared theta W. So another way of writing this whole factor, this one I can write very simply, it's just Q, because gamma left plus gamma right was 1. And this, so let me just rewrite this now up front here. I've got E over sine theta cos theta Z mu times T3 gamma left and nothing else, but minus Q sine squared theta W. And then the gamma left and gamma right combined to give me 1. Right? So that's the way I want to write the final interaction. So what the there's another way of writing the neutral current interaction is that it's sum over fermions of I over 2 IE over 2 sine theta cos theta Two is actually canceled, because you remember the story that made me, if I kind of, the step I skipped here, I had something, a left-handed piece and a right-handed piece. And when I did the W boson, I convinced you that the right-handed piece was actually the same thing as the left-handed piece. And so there's an overall factor of two that multiplied the whole interaction. The same story is true here, and so that's going to cancel this factor of two. Times fermion bar M. Times, let's write it out this way. Z mu, fermion bar, gamma mu, T3 gamma left minus Q sine squared theta, fermion. That's the Z coupling. And the electromagnetic coupling is a coupling of A. That's this term. It's just sum over fermions of I, E, A mu, fermion bar, gamma mu, charge, fermion. So this, you know, we're happy to see, because that's exactly the kind of coupling that we wanted the massless thing to have. The massless thing is coupling to the charge, and there's no gamma fives in here. So it's QED. It's what QED would have told you you should have had. And this is the thing, the new thing. There's the massive guy couples to this bigger combination. It's going to break parity because there's gamma left in here. So there's both a 1 and a gamma 5. But there's no matrices like the KM matrix, so CP is not going to be broken by this kind of interaction. And it doesn't mix different flavors. You always have the same, you never have up term bar, say. It's always up, up bar, term, term bar. So you never get any changes of flavor there. Yes, no, you can, definitely. Right, because it's, if you think of it, this destroys the fermion and it creates the antifermion. Once we've written it as Dirac fields, and then this is the opposite. It creates the fermion and destroys the antifermion. So you just, this would destroy the electron, this would destroy the positron, and this could create that. Oh, yeah, there's no choice for which this could cancel, because if I focus on the gamma 5 piece, it's just this. And everybody has a T3. In the case, it turns out that sine squared theta is 0.23 or something, so it's very close to a quarter. If it had been exactly a quarter, then Ah, right. If it had been exactly a quarter, then if you think of what this is in terms of ones and gamma fives, T3 is plus or minus a half for the neutrino and the electron. Gamma left is 1/2 times 1 plus gamma 5. Then you've got minus the charge times sine squared theta w. So for the electron in particular, q is minus 1. So this would be plus sine squared theta w. Whereas over here, for electron, it's minus 1/2. So you got, and the 2 1/2s combined to give you minus 1/4. So if sine squared theta w had been 1/4, the ones would have canceled. It would have been purely an axial gamma 5 interaction. And that's actually not so far from where nature is. It's sine squared theta w is not 1/4, but it's 0.23 rather than 0.25, so it's pretty close to 1/4. So a lot of the for electrons, there's a partial cancellation here, but you can kind of see that because there's two kinds of gamma matrices here, that you can't get a complete cancellation for any of the particles in the problem. So everybody couples to the Z boson. Right. Right. So it's a parity violating coupling, yeah. Well, it means so you're asking kind of how can you measure the difference between left and right hand couplings? Okay. Yeah. Yeah, and so actually, these couplings have been measured really, really accurately. So they know the left-handed coupling is different than right-hand coupling, and there's several ways you can do it. Not the first way, but the most direct way is you prepare a beam of electrons which is polarized, and you choose them to be very close to being left-handed or right-handed. And because they're not massless, there's some probability that if you start off with them being left-handed, they become right-handed. But if they're ultra-relativistic, that's very rare. So you can in practice do it. And so then they just measure the cross-section with left-handed ones, and then they re-measure it with right-handed ones, and they take the difference. And then and they can measure separately from that, compare that to the total cross-section where they add them, and you can separately infer the two couplings. And it's exactly what you would be told to do here. But before they did that, people already knew the difference was there, because if you look at E plus E minus goes to fermion, fermion bar, say, you can look at what you're looking for is something which knows about parity, so something which sees the difference between gamma 5 and 1. And so one way to do that is to, you have particles coming in, and say this is the E minus, that's the E plus, and that produces, say, a fermion and an antifermion in the center of mass frame. So you take the cross-section where you just integrate over when the fermion comes out in the front direction compared to the electron, and you take the cross-section where the fermion comes out in the back direction, and take the difference of those two things. And that's something which, in a parity invariant world, would be 0. And so even at low energies, when the Z particle is hard to produce, you can still see that difference, because this interaction interferes with the photon interaction. So the one term here can interfere with the photon. And so at low energies, you'll see when we do this that the photon dominates because it's lightest. And the lightest ones will dominate at low energies, you'll see. But this one, the interference of this one with this one shows you the gamma 5 term here. And so if you look at things like this that have been designed to be parity violating, you can pick out the fact that there's a parity violating coupling here. And you compare that to the total cross-section, which sees the sums of the squares of the couplings. And so you can dig them out with great precision, it turns out. And it really is a good, well described by this. That parity violating thing was done back in the Stone Age, in the 70s. That was the first evidence that there was a debate in the 70s about whether or not this was called in those days the Weinberg-Salam model. It predicted W bosons, photons, and the Z boson, but no one had actually seen the Z boson before. You knew the W boson was there because it mediated decays, which you knew had to be there, and you knew the photon was there. But this doesn't do anything that the photon doesn't do except for violating parity. And so there was an alternative model called the Georgi-Glashow model, which was designed in such a way as to not have a Z boson. So it was based on the group O3 breaking to O2, where there's, if you think about that, that has, O3 has 3 gauge bosons rather than 4, and you make one of them massless, so there's only 2 that are massive, and that's the W boson, and there's no neutral one at all. And so they, you know, so they really made different statements as to what you'd see in E plus and minus collisions. And this experiment that first saw this interference between priority violation of this and this was a big deal because it showed that there really were these neutral currents. So there was a neutral boson out there. And at the time, it's the usual thing that, you know, there were experiments that, that didn't see in atomic measurements that, you know, said that these things didn't exist. And so there's always a period when everybody's right. And then, but then it became definitive that the Zeds were there. So I've talked about the discrete symmetries. The section in here about, in the notes about the discrete transformations C and P, it just really fills in what you were asking before. So if you really want to see explicitly how the parity transformations change and why those things are invariant under CP, CNP, that's what section 2.5.1 is. So it's, but I won't repeat it because it's you know, it's a lot of banging just to get something which I've told you already. There's two more things I want to say here before we use this for something. One is, so one of the messages of the C and the P and the CP invariants was that you've got a theory which was not designed for its CP properties, but it has, by accident, specific selection rules under C and CP and P, which are going to turn out to describe pretty well what people see. Then you could ask more generally about the conservation laws. So, you know, I've written down almost all the interactions now, and one thing you can kind of see is that there's a symmetry to the whole problem where I take every fermion, every Dirac fermion in the problem and rotate it by the same phase. Every Dirac quark in the problem and rotate it by the same phase. That's a symmetry. It's a symmetry here because the phase that appears here cancels the phase that appears here. And in the W bosons, we had things like, you know, U bar D with gamma matrices and the W. And as long as I do these guys having the same phase, then there'll be a cancellation here. We had a matrix, you know, M and N, V, M, N. And so the fact that this matrix is here is the only thing that forces all these quarks to have the same phase in order for this to be a symmetry. But the fact that this is a symmetry was the reason we couldn't use that phase to simplify V. That's because it didn't appear anywhere. We could do that rotation and nothing happened. And so that was a sign that it was a symmetry. If you go back to the Higgs couplings, they involved F bar F. They're invariant of the phase because it's diagonal. And so every single term in this Lagrangian has the symmetry where all the quarks get rotated by a phase. All the leptons can also get rotated by a phase. And that's by the same argument because there's nothing that connects a lepton to a quark. But for the leptons, you have the additional statement that this matrix is not there. It's just delta Mn. So that you're free to rotate separately the electron and the electron neutrino by a phase and the muon and the muon neutrino by a different phase and the tau and the tau neutrino by a different phase again, which you wouldn't have been free to do if there had been a matrix like this in the W couplings. So that shows you that there's a symmetry in the problem, which wasn't designed to be there, but it is there. And those are important symmetries because they're observed to be to a very good approximation. The conservation laws that go with them are to a very good approximation satisfied. And one of the big successes of the standard models is satisfied for free. So claim is there is four parameter symmetry of all of these interactions. This is in addition to the gauge symmetries, which we designed the thing to have. And so that symmetry is all the quarks go to e to the I theta quark, and it's conventional to write theta over 3 times quark. Whereas the leptons all don't transform. That's symmetry number one. Symmetry number two would be the quarks don't do anything. You know, the electron and the neutrino electron go to e to the I theta electron and electron neutrino, but the other leptons don't change. Three. Just a conventional normalization. So just because I'm gonna write something else that'll use that normalization. So mu, tau, nu mu, nu tau unchanged. And three and four are the same things where I just have these guys rotate. So same, but now it's mu and nu mu which transform. E tau, nu e, nu tau. Changed, and then the last one will be. Oh, you can't read there? Sorry. Well, let me just, maybe I'll phrase it more economically. So the fermions go to e to the I theta times some charge, F fermion. So let's say, we'll use C for charge. So fermion times the fermion. And so the cases are C is equal to 1/3 for all quarks, zero otherwise. Second case was C was plus 1 for E, a new E, zero otherwise. Case 3 was C is plus 1 for mu and new mu, zero otherwise. And the fourth case is C is plus 1 for tau, mu tau, zero otherwise. And so, now it's important for these symmetries that theta is not function of x, right? This is a constant. If this is a function of x, then the kinetic terms, the derivatives of F would not be invariant. And it's because we haven't got a gauge field that couples to this conserved current that goes with this thing. So these are global symmetries and not local symmetries. But there is a conserved charge for this, so the Noether current J mu, the Noether current is just given by taking the Lagrangian and you vary it with respect to the derivative of the field that's transforming and multiply by the infinitesimal variation of the fields. And so that turns out to be basically I. So plus I times the sum over the fermions of fermion bar, C fermion, gamma mu, fermion. So then you just plug in the various C's. So it's, so in case number one, which is called baryon number, it's the current is just, the baryon current is just I times the sum over quarks times 1/3 because of this conventional choice, Q bar gamma mu Q. In the second case of lepton LE number, JE mu is just I E bar gamma mu E plus mu bar E gamma mu mu E and so on. And there's a similar for muon and the tau current, where it's just E mu E. So there's a conserved thing that goes with this. You know, the integral of this J0 over all space defines the charge. So in this case, CF is called B, and that's the baryon number charge. In this case, CF is called lepton number, electron number, and in the other cases, it's muon number and the tau number. And it's often true that the sum of these things is called total lepton number. And that sum is particularly important because we know there's evidence now that we'll get to later on that these are not separately conserved now as of the last 10 years, but there's no evidence yet that this sum is not conserved. And the main claim is that, which the book does in more detail, is that not only are these symmetries, but these are the only symmetries of the standard model that are not the gauge symmetries. So you get the symmetries. These are exactly the symmetries that have been seen phenomenologically to be conserved in nature, which I should say explicitly. But it's only these symmetries that are conserved. So the thing is that the standard model is by accident reproducing all of the symmetries and no more and no less than the symmetries that have been found experimentally over the previous decades to be required to describe what had been seen experimentally in order to understand the reactions that are seen. So the evidence for Berry number includes things like, let me say a sentence here. So these are precisely symmetries found experimentally. So for example, you never see the process. The proton, for instance, is two up quarks and a down quark. And each of these has Berry number a third, so that the proton has Berry number one. That's kind of why the third is there. So that has Berry number plus one. And it's the lightest thing which has Berry number. Because other things that are made of quarks involving quarks and antiquarks have no Berry number because it cancels between the quark and the antiquark. So because it's the lightest thing with a conserved charge, it has to be stable. Because if it was going to decay, it would have to decay into things that were lighter than it. But they, by assumption, can't have Berry number because this was the lightest one with Berry number. So there's nothing it can take to decay into if Berry number is conserved. So the absence of decays like proton to pi naught positron, that's allowed by all the other conservation laws we know. If that conserves electric charge, there's no reason why this couldn't have happened if you didn't know of a Berry number conservation. That's evidence for the conservation of Berry number. So proton being the lightest state with non-zero B must be stable if B is conserved. You never see a process like a muon decaying to an electron and a photon, say. Muons, almost all the time, they decay to an electron. An electron antineutrino and a muon neutrino. So this conserves the electron and muon number because the muon number of the muon gets carried off by the muon neutrino, and the electron number that you created with the electron is canceled by the negative electron number that the anti-electron carries. The electron is the lightest thing with electron number. It's the lightest thing with actually electric charge, so it's going to be stable. But electric charge would make it stable. You don't really need an electron number to make it stable. And there's a whole series of absence of things that phenomenologically built up the picture that these things are conserved. If you produce neutrinos using a beam, or using a reaction which involves E minus as being produced. So you have a process where some stuff comes in, it produces a neutrino, and in the process, say, produces an electron, or say, a positron. Then, until recently, it was always true that if you destroyed that thing in another reaction, then the charged particle that you saw here was always an electron. So that you never had, over here, a muon or a tau. Or if you produced a neutrino in a reaction involving a muon, you always found that the reaction over here involved muons, and you never found electrons and taus. And that's the thing which in the last 10 years has been found not to be true. This now happens where there's muons over here. So until those recent experiments were done, it was believed that electron number, muon number, and tau number were required to be conserved. And that was what was explaining the absence of events where electrons appear here and no electrons appear here. And it's the discovery of those reactions that tells you that electron and muon and tau number are not separately conserved. So there's a whole bunch of observational evidence that these things are conserved, and it's one of the nice features of the standard model that it predicts they should be conserved. Modulo one issue, which is the last issue today, of anomalies. It depends. So the simplest depends on exactly the details. Supposing it was true that you gauge symmetry and you don't break the symmetry, so it's the corresponding spin one particle would be massless. And that would mean that you would mediate a Coulomb force between any two things that carried parent number, say. And so that would be a long range force you could look for, which would be competing with the known forces. Like so you take an atom which is electrically neutral, and there's going to be a force mediated by the fact that the nucleus has got baryon number and electrons don't. And so that's a long-range force like that you wouldn't see competing with electromagnetism, but it would be competing with gravity. And it would have the property, and it would show up as being something which would make the force of gravity that you thought was gravity would really appear now to be chemical composition dependent, because two different atoms with the same mass, two isotopes, say, the same mass but different baryon number, or if you build something with, you know, you can build things that have, a planet. You know, people search for linear combinations of forces that are coupled to baryon number and lepton number. And then if you go to the sun is mostly hydrogen, so that's got a particular combination of baryon number and lepton number. But you go to other, planets, they have different kinds of combinations of baryon number and lepton number. And by seeing that all the observations are consistent with gravity being, satisfying the principle of equivalence, those constrain the existence of long-range forces coupled to baryon number and lepton number separately. But then you could say, so maybe the gauge symmetry is broken and those things have a mass. And so if you make the mass large enough, then that's a possibility. It depends on, so then there's a constraint above which the mass would have to lie. But it's a logical possibility that it is gauged, but the mass is heavy enough that it hasn't been seen. Another thing you would worry about if you had a massless thing coupled to baryon number would be that you'd actually produce, you could collide protons and antiprotons and produce these things if they had a low mass, and then you'd see them in accelerators in the same way that you see photons and you see, Z bosons. But if they're heavy enough, then we wouldn't have produced them. And so if you make them heavy enough, then you can get away with it. So then it's not known that they're not gauged in that kind of a scenario. But there's constraints on how it can happen. So the anomaly story is actually, I'm giving you a cartoon because this is, again, a subject in itself. But the bottom line about the anomalies, so the whole last 10 minutes has been about symmetries of the standard model. And symmetries are playing an important role in the standard model. Standard model is ugly. It's, you got to be its mother to love it at some level, because it's really, it's got all kinds of funny particle assignments. It's got a weird gauge group. It's not the prettiest thing, but what's beautiful about it is that it's the most general thing consistent with symmetry, with the gauge symmetries. And once you write down the and renormalizability, and once you look at the interactions you get, it also has these other symmetries, which are the ones that go with conservation laws we know should be there. And there's no extra conservation laws predicted beyond the ones that you want, and you're not missing any conservation laws. But symmetries are playing an important role in the whole story. Right, the consistency of the gauge interactions relied on Lorentz invariance together with unitarity, relied on there being gauge symmetries that the spin one particles are coupling to. The currents for conserved currents had to be coupled to. And the success of the description of these experiments is going to rely on these things being conserved. And what you really know so far is by looking at the Lagrangian, you know that the classical Lagrangian of the standard model is invariant under these symmetries. So we know that's true. the conclusion we'd like to argue is that something is conserved, say. And so you'd like to argue that, like to conclude there is an operator, a baryon number, which commutes with a Hamiltonian. And so the thing that's being finessed is that we're doing making a classical observation and drawing a quantum conclusion about it. And the conservation of these currents of B, which is to say the conservation of the current, J mu B. Can you see that? Is that too low again? Conservation of B, which is the conservation of this thing, relies on the equations of motion. And those are going to rely in general about how the operator ordering issues and L. So you might worry that there's some sort of a step missing between going from here to here and here. And there is a step missing. But you know, the attitude people took for decades was the one that physicists often take, is that, well, there's a step there, there's some details, the mathematicians will come in behind us and mop it all up, and you know, who cares at some level. And of course, the reason you care is that it might be false. And so it was discovered in the 60s that it had been believed that the symmetry of the classical action implied this conclusion. That, you know, all the consequences of symmetries in the quantum theory, and that the technical steps to do with finding an operator ordering, finding that there exists an operator ordering for which the classical conclusion assumption gives you the quantum conclusion, could always be done. It was assumed that you could always find some operator ordering for which everything worked. And the surprise was that it was found in the 60s that there are examples of cases where it's not true, that a classical symmetry is not sufficient to show that the corresponding quantum charge is conserved in the way that you would require to draw these conclusions about charges being conserved or degeneracy of states that are related by symmetries and things like that. And that was such a big surprise, they said those symmetries were anomalous. So the language is that it's supposed to be weird that this happened. Yeah. That's a good question. Typically, if you actually calculate for an anomalous, there's a question as to if this is false, then reactions like that will happen. And it often what happens is that the rate for these forbidden reactions, instead of being zero, it goes like e to the minus, you know, 8 pi over some coupling constant squared. And the thing that's controlling the classical limit is the smallness of the coupling. And so these things do go to zero when the coupling goes to zero, but they tend to do it in a way which is not perturbative, and you can't see in perturbation theory. So that was why that was one of the reasons why people didn't pick it up immediately, is that it wasn't really something you just hit if you're doing perturbation theory. So you reproduce the limit that the classical symmetry conclusions are true, but it's not sufficient to conclude necessarily that. So there's a quantitative issue as to whether or not you really care about this. So one of the things I'm going to argue is that there are anomalies in things like baryon number in the standard model, but in practice, it's so small that we don't care. Its protons are still stable as far as we're concerned, and that they would not be decaying in the history of the universe. And so, before you get that exotic, you could care in the early universe when the temperature of the universe is close to the electron weak scale, and you'd already care there. And so there are different predictions. And so in some regimes, you have to really care that either this is not true, but you have to be careful about that. For any particular case you're looking, you want to know that it's not an exact symmetry, but then you have to then quantify how big is the failure of the conservation. And in practice, is it something which is important for the thing you're interested in? And I'll tell you when we get there as to which ones. And in practice, for these global symmetries I'm talking about, these effects are not going to be important, so that they're effectively going to be conserved. So this was such a big surprise, they call them anomalies. And And I don't want to go through the argument as to why they're there. No way I could do it in the time we have available. I don't know if I could do it on top of my head anyway. But the good news is there's a very simple criterion for when this kind of thing happens. It typically, in four dimensions, happens only in the case where a symmetry distinguishes between left and right-handed particles. And so, first of all, if you have a symmetry acting on bosons only in four dimensions, this never happens. It's always true that classical symmetry implies quantum symmetry. The fermions are the tricky ones, and it's specifically the fermions that when symmetry is distinguished between left and right-handed particles that and treat them differently, that you have the possibility of this happening. So, and of course, we're doing that all the time in the standard model, because the gauge symmetries were designed to treat the left and right-handed particles differently. So there's really an issue in the standard model whether or not this step fails, because we're really relying on this in the consistency of the quantum mechanical interactions of the gauge bosons. But all we really know is that this is true. And so there's a step that needs to be checked. And what I'm about to do is give you the criterion that you can check. The thing that has to vanish for this step to be true is very simple to state. And so it's, and you'll see that it's very non-trivial how it gets satisfied in the standard model. That's how they were really discovered, that there's a symmetry that I haven't talked about yet. When I told you that there was a symmetry that you get only the symmetries that you see and no more and no less in the standard model, that's not quite right. There was a historical argument about that, because there was a symmetry in the strong interactions, which was not an exact symmetry, but an approximate symmetry, which, if it had been a symmetry, should have forbidden the neutral pion from decaying. Neutral pions almost always decay into two photons. And they decay faster than most pions do, because it's kind of an electromagnetic process. And but this rate would be much, much smaller. The symmetry that I'm alluding to would have said that this pion actually has to couple derivatively. It has to have interactions which go to zero in the limit that its energy goes to zero. And if you calculate the decay rate under that assumption, you get it wrong. You get it dramatically wrong compared to what you actually see. But there's an anomaly in that particular symmetry, which you can calculate the size of. And if you then ask how big would be the corresponding rate for this decay to happen, you get it right. So there's real experimental evidence that anomalies happen in some cases. In the gauge interactions, there are no anomalies, and that's kind of why you're allowed to have them. There's no known gauge theory which has anomalies in it that... So the belief is that the gauge theory with anomalies is just not a Lorentz invariant theory, or it's not a unitary theory. So it's sick in one of the fundamental levels that you didn't want to, that we were excluding at the very beginning of the class. But if you have a global symmetry like these ones, which is not a symmetry of principle, it just happens to be there, and it's anomalous. What you're really saying is that it's not really an exact symmetry; it's an approximate symmetry, and then it's a question of how badly broken it is. And that's what these things are all about. You're calculating how big the violations of the symmetry are. But there's some cases where they have to be violated. There really is an issue where you can test that they're being violated the way you think they should be. So let me just state the criterion, and I won't do the sums yet, but it's just so that we can stop. So the statement is that the fermions are the dangerous ones. And so let's say we take all the fermions and write the left-handed parts in a huge column vector. So take phi or psi to be the left-handed electron, the left-handed positron, the left-handed up quark, the left-handed everybody. So it's the left-handed Andy up quark. And so I'm just keeping all the left-handed ones. And any symmetry involving the fermions can be written as a big matrix acting on this, which might be reducible. It might be very reducible, but it's some matrix. So we're interested in things like delta psi is equal to I, some matrix times F times psi. And that's what I would mean by that. This is the charge that defines the symmetry. So it might be plus 1/3 for all the quarks and minus 1/3 for all the anti-quarks. If we're talking baryon number, it's for any of these symmetries we're interested in, you can decide what this matrix F is. Now the criterion is, it turns out that When there's anomaly, so when there is an anomaly, what normally happens is that the divergence of the current. So there's some current. In fact, let me say we got a bunch of these symmetries. So we'll have theta A, F A. So each one has the current. It won't be zero, but it's often related to the. Its failure to be zero is often related to the gauge fields of the problem. So let me write this down. So there's a coefficient, AABC, times a number to do with the gauge couplings, GA, GB, and I think it's 64 pi squared, times epsilon mu nu lambda rho FB mu nu FC lambda rho. So the failure of the current for the symmetry to be conserved for the fermions is related to this current would be conserved in the absence of these gauge fields, but if you're in the presence of these gauge fields, the current is not conserved because of the anomaly. And so this coefficient is kind of the key to the whole story. If you know how to calculate this coefficient, if that coefficient is zero, then this thing is conserved and you can forget about the fact there could have been an anomaly. And so this thing is called the anomaly coefficient, and it's got a very simple statement as to what it is. So this anomaly coefficient has three labels on it, one for the current whose symmetry you're looking for, whether it was anomalous, and two for the symmetries that are being gauged, whose presence as fields would be the thing that triggers the failure of the symmetry to be a symmetry at the quantum level. This thing, it turns out, has a very symmetrical form, and it's the trace of the FA, the anti-commutator of FA with FB with FC. And I think I'm going to put in a half here because of the anti-commutator. This has the property that it's completely symmetric. In all the indices. And that's actually an important property that it's really true that you have some sort of a choice as to where the anomaly is. That if there's an anomaly, there's a it looks very asymmetrical. But this current is the current that you're looking at, whether it's conserved, and these ones are some gauge fields, which are also associated with gauge symmetries. But this coefficient is very symmetrical in all these charges, and so it's really true that there's more symmetry. Although this looks like this side is much different from this side, there's really a sense in which the symmetries are all treated in an equal way. And if you want to know whether a particular symmetry is anomalous, what you have to ask is, for all possible choices of these gauge fields, gauge symmetries, is this zero for the charge that you're interested in? Oh, that should be GBGC, sorry. There's one, it's one for each of these things. Sorry. More money for you. So let me just kind of show you one example of how this works, just to get a sense of what's going on. So you see this. The statement is so the symmetry for charge FA is not anomalous if there is no choice of two gauge generators FB and FC, for which AABC is non-zero. How many negatives do we have there? Symmetry is not anomalous if there is no choice of two gauge symmetries. Wow, that's is anomalous if there is any choice of two gauge generators FB, if which A is non-zero. Good. There. It's like the old joke, right? The linguistics professor tells the class, there are some languages in which a double negative means a negative, and some languages it means double negative means a positive, but there's no languages in which the double positive means a negative. And the student says, yeah, right. So just to give you an example of that, let's take the case where we have, take the simplest example. Let me just take the simplest example here. So let's take the case of, so hypercharge is an example of a symmetry which treats left and right-handed particles differently. And what I'll do is I'll show you, I'm going to focus on the anomaly where we have, let's take FA is equal to hypercharge, FB and FC are in SU3 color. So those are two gauge generators. And I'm going to show you that this vanishes, and it's not trivial how it vanishes. But I'm not done when I've done this. I have to then go through all the other things for all the SU2 and all the U1 generators and show that they all vanish to conclude that Y is not anomalous. So this trace would be trace of Y, FB, FC. This trace is over all the fermions, right? It's this whole thing. So let me call that capital trace. That's what I did there. You know, Y is just a multiplicative number for all these things. Whereas the generators for color are acting on the color indices that I haven't written here, right? And so those things are, they act in separate spaces. And so I can take the trace over the color indices separately from the trace over the hypercharges. And so that's a sum over all the triplets and anti-triplets. Because all the fermions are either triplets or anti-triplets if they're colored at all. Of the hypercharge of that fermion times the trace of the generators of SC3 in the triplet or anti-triplet representation. And it turns out this trace is for triplets or anti-triplets is always essentially a half times delta AB. So it's the same for all of them is the main thing. So this whole thing is proportional to the sum over all the triplets, which is essentially all the quarks, of the hypercharge of the quark. And so you can do that sum, right? We have, let me close with that. So we have, there's three colors for every quark. And so what do we have? We have the left-handed quarks, then we have the right-handed ones. And so we'll take the left-handed anti-quarks, left-handed anti-quarks. So we have a doublet of these guys, and their hypercharge was 1/6. The hypercharge of these guys was they're equal to the electric charge, and that was minus 2/3 and 1/3. So we have 1/6 times 2, because there's two of them. We've already got the color. And we have plus 1/3 for this guy. Minus 2/3 for this guy. And there's also, sorry, this 3 comes from the generations. The color trace is already here. This is the number of generations. So if I've done that right, so 2/3 is, 2/6 is 1/3 plus 1/3 is 2/3 minus 2/3 is about 0. Right? But now you do this again for hypercharge doublet SU2, SU2, and that means the sum over all the doublets of hypercharges has to be 0. And you do it again for hypercharge Lorentz generator to Lorentz generator, because you don't want to gauge anomaly with gravity. And then the sum of a hypercharge over all the fermions has to be 0. And you do it again for three hypercharges. The sum of the cubes of the hypercharge have to all be 0. And if you plug them all in, all these sums are 0. And it's you know, there's many, many constraints for each generation. And the charge assignments are actually, there's not a lot of charges, hypercharges you could have chosen and made these constraints all be satisfied apart from the ones that have been chosen in the standard model. So it's an important clue to the whole standard model that the fermion content is chiral. So whenever you have something which treats left and right-handed particles differently, which I didn't write here, this, I'll start with this next time, is that A, ABC equals 0 unless symmetry is chiral. And chiral just means treats left-handed and right-handed differently. So you can prove that if it's not chiral, you can prove that this is always zero. And so there's two cases where you can prove this is always zero. If it's not chiral, and if something is in a real representation of a symmetry, it's also true that this is zero. But it's an important clue about nature that the standard model comes in this chiral, you know, has this chiral symmetry pattern, where all the anomalies are exactly canceling in a very non-trivial way. So let's stop there.